Hello and welcome to the AB Forums podcast for the 20th November 2013. And joining me for this edition are games editor Mark Botwright.
They don't want rubber sheets, they want straight jackets.
That was mine.
He's now desperately trying to find another quote.
The hospital is getting too small for us, Doctor. Well, you're... Oh, that's not funny. Well, you're not all that big, matron. Sorry.
And last but by no means least, audio reviewer Ed Selly.
Matron, no!
Right, well, as you probably realised, Phil is still away, so you're stuck with me again for another week, unfortunately. And we'll get straight into the hardware news, which is also me, actually, because I currently have, this week, the Sony VPL VW500ES 4K, or UHD, depending on who you ask, projector. And obviously, this is big news when it was launched at IFA, because at £8,500, it's significantly cheaper than the previous 4K projector, which was the VW1000, which was about 17,000 quid. And I'm lucky enough to have the VW1000 in my home previously, got this one in now. I've got to say, I haven't done any in-depth testing yet, but so far, it looks really good.
Any obvious differences to the
Yeah. When you start looking at the chassis, you can see where they're cutting all the corners. There's a lot of light spill for one thing. The lens is nowhere near. I mean, obviously the lens is different. I mean, the lens on the VW1000 was all glass, 18 pieces. This is a plastic front and glass within, 13-piece lens. But the build quality, the weight, the chassis, the size, they're all significantly different. I mean, fair enough to Sony. I mean, they're trying to hit a relatively low price point for a 4K projector. And to do that, they've had to shave off a fair few corners. And you can see, if you've seen the previous projector, you can tell where they've been doing that. But in terms of performance, you know, I've got no complaints whatsoever. It looks absolutely gorgeous. A lot of people, me included, and I'm sure you'd agree with this, Mark, is that, you know, if you're talking about 1080p content on a 1080p panel, you don't want any sharpening.
Yeah.
But when we're talking about 1080p content on a 4K panel, to a certain extent, you have to add a degree of sharpening because
there's got to be something being done there. Sorry, we're talking over each other.
Yeah, exactly. You're going to be scaling up to the panel's native resolution. So there's obviously rarity creation. There's a little bit of sharpening going on, but I found it to be highly effective. Certainly, watching 1080p content on it, it does look. You know it isn't more detailed. It visibly can't be, but there's still a perception that it looks more detailed on a big screen. And the motion handling looks good. Bat levels are excellent. I've got it in reference mode, which is I've got to say, to the eye at least, extremely accurate out of the box. So far, I'm extremely impressed with the projector.
With the dynamic iris, just as impressive.
Actually, I've not been using it. I turned it on, turned it off, turned it on, tried it out a few times. And I've got to say, the native blacks are pretty good. And I wasn't seeing a huge improvement in black levels by putting on the dynamic iris, actually.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Because, I mean, it's got a lot of positive feedback, hasn't it, the previous models for the way the iris is handled.
Obviously, that's a technology that has improved over time. And when it first came on the market, which was probably a good, you know, at least, 10 years? How long has that dynamic iris been around? It's been around a long time. And initially, you could hear the iris moving, you could see it reacting to changes in contrast in the image. Now they're much, much faster and a lot more accurate. And some of the well-implemented ones, like Sony, certainly do a very good job. And interestingly, I know we mentioned this before in a previous podcast, but obviously JVC have now introduced dynamic iris to their projector, surprisingly.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, we've seen improvements with some of the TV. Sorry, it's not exactly the same, but the dimming systems, which is akin. I noticed big improvements in that in the last sort of 12 months. So they seem to be getting there on that front.
Well, on some manufacturers, at least.
Certain manufacturers. All right, yeah, Samsung. All right, Samsung and Sony, that's it. All the others are crap.
There's still a lot more testing to be done, but certainly my initial impressions are extremely positive. I mean, I've seen it a couple of times previously, one at the AV Forums event we had in London last month and also at IFA. And it's a really impressive projector.
Did they give you much content to watch this time? Was it the same?
None whatsoever.
They could have thrown in one of them 4K media players, couldn't they?
Yeah, they could. So I had to use that stuff that LG gave me.
Whoosh.
That's funny.
I actually upped my eyeballs in 4K at the moment because I've also got the Philips 65-inch PF9708.
Yeah, 4K in every room.
Yeah, I've actually got 4K in both of the main rooms now. Who says it's not here, hey?
Yeah. Get Cobham. The heart of 4K.
I've got to say, pretty good TV. I mean, looking at it, I can see, I don't know exactly which panel they're using. I think it might be LG. It's passive 3D, which usually is a clue.
Or at least the same one that LG are using.
Yeah, quite. And reading your review of the Panasonic, there seemed to be some similarities in terms of a bit of banding and a bit of motion handling issues.
Yeah, and also the black levels and the colour performance was very similar out of the box, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well,
the difference with the Panasonic and the LG, of course, was one was active and one was passive. So that was that's an interesting difference.
So whilst I'm not totally blown away by the Philips, it does have one major advantage over the Panasonic and the LG. It's £1,000 cheaper. So it's only £4,500, which is, you know, a significant difference in price, which I think you can probably, you know, tolerate some minor issues when you're saving yourself £1,000.
I think you're more likely to forgive it, aren't you? And this time, 6 months down the line, there'll be another grand off that. You can almost guarantee it.
Yeah, well, I mean, Toshiba, I think, are doing a 65-inch for $4,200. So, you know, I think by Christmas, we're going to see the 65 inches hitting about 4K.
Yeah.
Sorry, well, 4K for 4K.
Yeah.
There you go. And, you know, that's an attractive price point for a 65-inch television when you would pay three and a half for a 1080p of that screen size.
Yeah, it starts to get into some more realistic category, doesn't it?
All we need now is some content.
Yes, please. I still can't get that Netflix content to play it 24 at the right resolution.
But, okay, so I've got 4K in two rooms at the moment. However, and this is a story then that you put up, Mark, the public are still watching, or not even watching, high definition as much as we like to think they are.
Yeah, slightly depressing story. It was comes from Humax, a set-top box and PVR manufacturers. So it's obviously slanted to make their products seem desirable. So the focus was on demand. And basically they were saying there's more people interested in streaming services such as iPlayer than HD even. So never mind Ultra HD. Only 22% of people considered HD as an essential for the next purchase, if it's a set-top box purchase, remember, not television. And I think it was 3% for 3D, which is probably not too surprising. But
as much as that,
it was probably more than you'd expect. But it just kind of gives you a reality check. We live in this world, don't we, where we're always talking about this, but most people are just, I haven't got a clue. And you've got to imagine that it'll be very low on the list for Joe Public's next feature requirement on the next video purchase.
Well, to be honest, it's not incredibly surprising from an audio perspective. I've been watching it unfurl over the last 10, 15 years. Convenience trumps quality every single time. The only time that quality actually is in any way able to take a hold is when it also happens to be the most convenient option, or going further back in time, the only option. So it's momentarily depressing, but when you just, you know, if you visit other households and stuff, I mean, you go and see people and they're watching televisions with bright orange faces. All the work we did for Picture Perfect might as well been for nothing. The classic phrase is pissing into an ocean of piss, and you know, there's not a lot you can do about that, really, is it? But, you know, by the same token, it shouldn't be taken as a sort of, you know, nihilist. What's the point? Just give up. You've got to, you unfortunately just always have to temper any qualitative argument with trying to ensure that it either doesn't impede convenience or in some small way can aid it.
Yeah, funnily enough, just as we were talking about that, just some news came. It's nothing big, nothing major news, but the CEA have just announced that they're about to, this is the Consumer Electronics Association, are about to embark on a big marketing campaign for Ultra HD and to try and sell the benefits to the public. So I'd be interested to see what little slogans and catchphrases they can come up with there to try and sell it to the public.
I mean, going back to what we were saying a couple of podcasts ago, when the test shooting of that football match was done in 4K. As you say, the instant ability to sort of, you like, do without the sort of zoom in cameras because you just use the same one is going to, you know, it will affect how the match can be shown, how you can get to information very, very quickly. I see that being a very logical point where, if you like, it's not convenience so much as, but the effectiveness of the presentation goes beyond simply increasing the resolution, and stuff like that will start to win out over some, you know, classic qualitative argument.
I totally agree with you, Ed. It's just that with current technology, there's no reason why you can't have both convenience and quality. You know, I mean, Netflix is a streaming service, but their super HD, as they call it, looks surprisingly good, even down my rubbish internet connection, which is basically just a copper wire. You know, it still looks quite watchable, even on a decent sized screen. So there's potential to deliver both convenience and quality if the consumer wants it. I mean, I just get slightly concerned if the consumer isn't placing much emphasis on resolution as a key factor in their decision to buy a product. That doesn't really bode well for an industry that is pretty much putting all their eggs in one 4K basket right now.
But
go on, Mark.
I was just going to say, isn't there a chance there's a little bit of wiggle room in the way that it's worded as an essential, you know, consideration?
I said at the top. It was slanted to highlight the, you know, the features of this particular or their particular range of products as being good for on demand. So yeah, you have to take it with a slight pinch of salt. But then with a basis in reality, just from talking to friends and family, they couldn't really give a monkey's about it.
But Mark Botwright, at the risk of picking an open scab here, you've recently done an article about resolution in video games. You know, and it's been a bit of an uproar, not just about your article, but about the fact that you know, some of the launch Xbox One games are still in 720p.
Yeah, I mean, but that was it's a very, very, very kind of it's a minefield, because as has been rightly pointed out, it's in terms of games, image quality rests on so many other things other than just resolution. What it does tell you is that perhaps there's one console is easier to develop for than the other. But as things play out, should we say, the gap shouldn't seem as massive. And if you get niceties in there, if you get, you know, there are so many other things affecting the image other than just resolution.
What's Rise native resolution?
That'll be 900p.
900p. Still looks massively impressive.
So yeah,
I wouldn't be bothered if that was, you know, 920p, 900p, 10p or whatever it looks like that. Then I don't
really 10p you'd probably notice.
Yeah, you might
notice. 10p you would notice, but there again, there are some great little kind of pixel art games out there.
Yeah, it's as much about it, isn't it? Textures and effects and, you know, shading and lights and all the rest of it. It's not, it isn't just resolution, is it?
No.
You mentioned gameplay there.
But as we all know, no one jumps into, you know, paying out full price for a launch console based solely on gameplay. And as we're starting to see some of the reviews trickle in now, that's becoming clearer by the moment.
That's the theme, isn't it? Yeah, it's a great piece of hardware. Just need some games to back it up.
Right, we'll come back to that, Mark.
Oh, sorry, yeah, we're jumping ahead, aren't we?
Spoilers. okay, well, that's enough video for 1 week. Ed, you were a bit quiet last week, so I'll give you a chance to talk a bit more today. You've just been on a visit, I believe, to Lynn.
Yes, I have. It was, as I say, first time I've been to Scotland this century. I'm pleased to report it's still there and it's lovely. Lynn is 40 this year, and It was really a very interesting visit because it was a very, very impressive balance of how they've taken philosophies which were in place when they got started all those years ago, and they're still pushing them in a way which is completely relevant for what's going on in audio now, without at the same time alienating people who perhaps don't want to go all the way in that direction. The most significant thing they demonstrated was their Exact system, with a K, naturally. Obviously. And
can't spell anything right these days, can you? It's not what the cool kids do.
I wouldn't take that up. But it's effectively, it takes two Lin concepts that they've held dear. One, which dates all the way back to pretty much day one, which is active loudspeakers. The second, a more recent thing, where they are tremendous advocates of UPnP streaming. And they have combined it to produce a system where the vast majority of decoding, processing, and obviously amplification is all taking place within the speaker, which is having interesting results on the crossovers, time domain, and then the behavior of the speaker in room itself. And yeah, the most significant thing is that it's very interesting to compare what Lin are doing, which they describe as room optimization, when you then look at how AV receivers and multi-channel goes about sort of, if you like, bludgeoning rooms into behaving themselves and then calling that sort of room correction. The Lin process uses no microphones. It's entirely mathematical and sort of algorithm based. And I have to be honest, it genuinely has a very, very positive effect on what's going on. As I said in the piece, which has either gone up or will shortly go up, I can't say that I've been a huge fan of Lin speakers up to this point. I kept that to myself whilst I was there. I didn't sort of run around going, oh, I hate your products. But they really have managed to take all of the innate potential that they've had in these active loudspeakers, and it's just cleaner, faster, much more believable in terms of tonality. And yes, I mean, don't get me wrong, we're talking about a significant chunk of money that no one was talking about price tags, but it isn't going to be given away. Given that the flagship active speaker before this exact engine, as they call it, has been added to it, was about £34,000-£35,000, this is not going to be cheap. But it is a significant step forward in what they were in terms of their sonic performance. And most interestingly is that they aren't ruling out making this an open standard where with an, you know, a applicable license. And I have to say, in terms of just getting speakers to behave themselves in relatively sensible rooms, it just felt much more natural than when you'd often listen to systems which have been fairly heavily EQ'd using the microphone-based exercises. And it can be quite convincing for films, but then if you just ask them to play in two-channel, it all sounds a bit forced and a bit synthetic. So, yeah, there's a lot of potential there. And then just to make sure that we weren't all sort of convinced that they were gunning for the future and leaving their older customers behind, you can now you might be able to buy, if you're A, lucky, and B, rich, a very limited edition version of their LP12 turntable, which has a plinth made out of Highland Park whiskey barrels, is otherwise a full LP12 SE spec, and is yours for a significant £25,000.
25 grand for a second-hand whiskey barrel and a turntable stuck on top of it.
You do get a bottle of whiskey, which is worth, I think, £2,000 in its own right. I mean, obviously, from the perspective of anyone teetotal, that's going to just be rubbing yeah, salt.
Or you just that's worse than the Kinect camera.
But it's the LP12 is a funny thing. I've owned two because I'm mental. But yeah, it's still a fairly iconic product, and it's just nice to see that. It's, if you like, it's the audio industry's Porsche 911. It looks recognisably similar to the one that they released in 1972. And indeed, you can take a 1972 one and make it exactly the same as a 2013 model. But no, other than the actual plinth itself, I don't believe any other single component has gone without some form of change or modification. And it's quite clever how it's still recognisably the same, but at the same time, completely different. And if anyone from Lynn is listening and they, you know, want to leave with one with me on long-term loan, I'll forego the bottle of scotch. I'm not an unreasonable man. I still got a soft spot for them. I'm sure I'll go around to get around to buying another one day, probably in addition to the turntables I've already got, you know, because a man can't get by with less than two or three of them.
Well, it's comforting to know that the audio world remains as bonkers as ever, Ed.
Well,
if it's not an espresso machine, he's not interested.
No, that was me talking about espresso machines. He's a Coke guy.
All I would say is that I bet you'll get more of your 25 grand back on your special anniversary LP12 than on any of the flagship release 4K products in, say, 5 years' time.
I guarantee
that.
That's
a fair.
So, whilst yes, spending £25,000, especially when the performance difference between that and a standard LP12 SE, which is still, I think, about £20,000. There's no Lynn refused to be drawn on whether the heavier plinth made out of whiskey oak makes any difference. But yeah, okay. There's only 40 of them. They're very, very hard to fake. So I'm sure that they'll be sort of, you know, sought after little things for years to come.
Okay. Well, that article's up now, so give it a read. That's it for hardware news. We're back in a second with games news. If you haven't been living under a rock for the last few months, you'll probably realize that last Friday in the States, the Sony PS4 was finally launched. And Mark, sales look pretty promising from that perspective, at least.
Yes, sold over 1 million in a day. So they've broken previous Sony consoles record. Obviously, I mean, this is only for North America, so just for the States and Canada. Obviously off to a great start, but there was a huge amount of stock there. So obviously kind of the amount of stock that had been amassing obviously allows for these things to kind of escalate each time. You expect each console almost to launch to better the last now. It'll be very interesting to see what the Xbox One does when that launches on Friday. As I say, very big projected 3 million by the end of the year, 5 million by the end of the financial year. So they look pretty much, you know, on a level footing to get that, and pretty much beat the Wii U's measly little 3.9 million that it's managed to amass thus far.
Is that worldwide sales numbers?
Yeah. I've got a feeling that is, yeah.
There is, it's global, that 3.9. They'll catch the Wii U by February.
Oh, easily.
Which is depressing for Nintendo.
So does that mean then there's plenty of them knocking around, not going to be going for like silly money on eBay?
Well, this is the strange thing. I mean, there's stock still kind of dribbling out. Some of the supermarkets are still offering things day one consoles for both of them. And at the same time, eBay, you know, there are still people scalping. There are still people making, you know, 50 quid, 100 quid on just, you know, pre-orders, which just seems mad. Just seems though people have taken in this line that they have definitely sold out. Most shops are going with the standard line of, you know, you've got no chance and we can guarantee it for Christmas. And people have taken that to mean that, you know, they will have zero opportunity to pick one up, but they are still kicking about because there's, as with anything, whenever these things get announced, people rush to several different shops, put in a pre-order with each. And then at some point they might upgrade to a bundle with one of them and then think, should I bother keeping the pre-orders? And then a certain amount of them then fall back. You know, it's like unclaimed tickets at the theatre.
Yeah. I mean, I actually ordered a PS4 in June on Amazon. I cancelled it at the weekend because, frankly, it looks rubbish as far as I'm concerned. It's just a games console. Doesn't play 3D Blu-rays. Doesn't do MP3, doesn't do CD, doesn't do DNA. You have to do an upgrade immediately to play 2D Blu-rays and DVDs. I just thought, you know what? I just rather get a Blu-ray player.
I don't 3D Blu-rays. I know the Xbox One wasn't doing 3D Blu-rays.
PS4 as well. No, that's confirmed as well. It won't currently play. Weird.
Well, it just seems bizarre.
Yeah. I do love just taking an isolation, Steve. Your fury there is man upset that games console is games console.
That's the modern world.
Originally, that's true. Yes, I am. But the PS3, you see, wasn't a games console, was it? It was a media digital hub, effectively.
Well, that's the exact opposite of what what they did. That's a mistake they made with the PS3, wasn't it? They were saying it was this all-in-one box of solutions and didn't appeal to the core gamers early on. And they've gone the opposite way around and seems to have been fairly successful.
Fairly successful, certainly with regards pre-launch hype, but there have been software and hardware issues that, you know, it's strange. These things always seem to come as a surprise to people that somehow... Yeah.
You know, 1 million consoles, people will have problems, won't they? There will be faulty units out there. What does worry me slightly about the hardware, and it's obviously early days, is it's so much smaller to the Xbox One. Having seen some comparison shots now, And it just worries me that they've got it in too small a housing now, and there will be problems ahead, but obviously we'll wait and see on that. But how can Sony make something so much smaller, which is essentially the same and only a bit more powerful than the Xbox One, yet put it in a box so small and hope to keep it cool?
But you say that, but that said, isn't it for the PS3, it's the fat ones that have a habit of going wrong. The thin ones have been comparatively robust. So I don't necessarily think I wouldn't simply rely on the
equate size. I just equate size with goodness.
Well, the fat ones though were the original ones, right? So obviously the slimmer ones have had more development time. But I am amazed at how small it actually is. It really is quite tiny, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's
2 inches high, and it's pretty small.
Yeah, I was under the impression before they came, they were coming out just from press shots, that they were pretty much the same size. But there's nothing like, is it? The Xbox One's a beast.
There again, the Xbox One is intended to be left on pretty much all the time.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, you've got to take that into account. I mean, they were obviously taking absolutely no chances with overheating or anything like that.
Yeah, the original Xbox was just such a tank, wasn't it? That was all. You'd never think that was going to break down. Mine's still working, I believe. But yeah, the 360 was just a plastic lump of turd, wasn't it?
Isn't it? A number of original Xboxes are still working because there wasn't actually much to do on them. So they've actually cumulatively had virtually no hours put on them, even though they're 10 years old.
The original Xbox is fantastic.
Yeah, fantastic. That's one of my favourite consoles, but if not my favourite console.
I'm with you there.
Just ripped it, used to store music on, I seem to remember. Possibly some gentleman's, you know, video material.
Specialist material.
Yeah, specialist stuff.
Back in your specialist subject now.
What can I say?
What about the launch games then, Mark? So what was the lowdown on those?
Launch games have got slightly disappointing reviews. Shuya Yoshida, who's the kind of head honcho of SCE Worldwide Studios, has come out to say, in fact, that he's a bit disappointed to see some of the low scores. Killzone Shadowfall, which was kind of the big first-person shooter exclusive, it certainly still ticks all the right boxes for, you know, something to show off with the system because it looks fantastic, but it's getting, you know, reasonable scores, which is about, you know, I'm surprised that anyone really expected a lot more from
it's Killzone. They've all been the same.
I was going to say, but I mean, there was talk they're going for a less linear approach this time, so you know, you can tackle objectives in your own manner, and so it'll be closer to the kind of Half-Life model, but it was never likely to actually hit those heights. It's kind of graphical sheen and, you know, bombast, and that, you know, that's enough for me. The big kind of surprise, I suppose, is Knack, because that comes from Mark Cerny, who's the PlayStation 4 lead architect and also the creative director of this game, and it's just getting pretty much panned for slightly antiquated approach. But again, that's been described as a secondary purchase by, I think it was Yoshida said that it's really like a supplementary game, which sounds
like
almost
full
like
price, presumably.
I was going to say $50 or potentially $60. That's you know, a bit hard just to kind of throw the kids away and to justify it.
Is it a bit like Katamari Damacy a little bit? I've not seen much about Knack.
It seems to be a bit like that. It's 2D platformer, kind of not 2D. Sorry, kind of action platformer. With that general approach of you kind of build this monster and it just looks a little bit meh. You know, it seems like most of the reviews have kind of summed that up. And then just as we're recording this, we're getting I think the embargo's lifting for the Xbox One launch game reviews, and shock horror that they're coming out
the same.
No, they're coming out a lot better, I think.
Are they?
Early look from you know, things like Dead Rising 3, even though it looks pretty much every inch the Xbox 360 title that's been ported over, with a few little bells and whistles on it, it plays like a Dead Rising game, which is fun. Lots of zombies on screen and lots of things to kill. I'd be surprised if Forza doesn't, you know, hit the heights again. And so it's pretty much where people thought it was, you know, kind of back towards E3 and the like, which is Xbox One has the better lineup, but you've got the more expensive console. PS4 looks like the more dedicated gaming machine with a bit more grunt, but there's not really that killer app yet. So it'll be interesting.
Often the case, isn't it, with launch. I mean, buying a console at launch, you can't expect much, can you, generally?
I was just going to say, that's exactly right. But it was funny, because of the amount of bad press that Microsoft got, a lot of people were saying that, you know, they were going to get practically slaughtered. And then there were several analysts who came out and said that, in fact, you know, it would be pretty much 50-50, certainly for North America. And some even gave Microsoft the nod to get a slim lead, kind of, you know, more in the realm of 51-49 kind of thing. But still, it was... you know, sounded a little bit absurd, well, given
the 360 has trounced the PS3 in North America, hasn't it, in terms of sales? So it's going to have a large entrenched gold account, gold live, gold membership, which is, you know, it sort of carries you over into the next generation, as it were, because you can take your gold with you, can't you, to Xbox One, and it's built up that multiplayer reputation for being easier than the PSN. Just think a lot of people will stick with it just on those grounds, that they'll want to keep all their live friends and all the rest of it, and like the infrastructure for multiplayer. So I don't think it'll do shockingly badly. I don't think it'll do as well globally as the 360 has. But yeah, I still see it being strong.
Oh yeah, and it is actually quite funny to see some of the kind of reactions towards the hardware and software, particularly software issues with regards to the PS4 launching, because it does seem to have played into pre-existing stereotypes, which is that you know, Sony can't do the software side of things, they can't do firmware, they don't create as slick a kind of UI as Microsoft do, and so therefore when you've got things like crashes and the like, and you know, consoles that it seems as though, you know, the HDMI cable isn't syncing, or you know, that you can't see the screen, all of a sudden people are saying, oh, is this just launch worries, or is this, you know, signs that things aren't going to be as clear cut as previously envisaged? No, but there's already this kind of dubbed blue light of death, which is, it's one of those things, it's going to be a question, it'll take a month or two to work out whether this is in fact a myth that's being playfully built up by some. If you look at Amazon, the amount of one-star reviews for the PS4, the amount of people who claim to have had a unit that's dead on arrival seems strangely high.
So you say 0.4%, is it, or something?
Yeah, 0.4%, which is, you know,
we're not going to get the real idea of that for months, are we, really? Because there'll be many a console, I'd imagine, being bought for a Christmas present, so they won't even been opened.
Well, 1% of a million is 10,000, right? So that's like, was it 4,000 units? That's still quite a lot of people can be moaning on Amazon, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. I said the internet amplifies these things, doesn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Because you don't go online to, you know, if you have a good experience, you don't tend to go online and
if your console's working, about it. You'll be playing on it, won't you? Not moaning on Amazon.
You're pitching on Amazon.
No, but I mean, yeah, it's pretty much split now between 5-star reviews and 1-star reviews. And there's a question about basically how many people have been able to use that many of the features thus far, simply because there's a day one update for it, which is to put in place so much of the functionality. I mean, when you look at exactly what it's there for, it's remote play, online multiplayer, second screen, Blu-ray and DVD, recording and screenshots, you know, the Twitch functionality, voice chat. It's pretty much everything that's non-absolutely essential gameplay related is needing to be there in an update. And so obviously the servers have been absolutely inundated, which has led to, I'm sure, not a little consternation.
Okay. Well, that's it for the PS4 launch. Obviously on Friday, we've got the Xbox One launch in the UK. The PS4 obviously lies in the UK a week on Friday. But we'll find out, I guess, for next week's podcast, how you're getting an Xbox One yourself, Mark? Hodgkinson
not at launch. No, I almost certainly will down the line, but not at launch.
Other Mark,
I will do at some point, but not at launch currently.
He's getting one at launch, then. Who on the games team is going to be reviewing it?
Leon's getting one at launch. I'm pretty sure Manny is. I'm pretty sure Steve is. There's a fair amount who are getting that.
You're happy with your Wii U, aren't you? You'll be fine.
Yeah, I got my Wii U.
Well, we'll look forward to their feedback next week's podcast. Well, that's it for Games News. We'll be back in a minute with Tech News. Okay, kicking off Tech News, we've got Asus, who's announced a Miracast dongle, Mark. So what's this all about?
Well, we've seen this kind of thing built into TVs before. So it just allows your Miracast enabled smartphone or tablet to display whatever's on there on the big screen. So it's very simple, really. So it means you could stream all your Netflix or YouTube, play your games or whatever on the big TV rather than your handheld. As I say, it's been built into many a TV we've had.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. It's built into a lot of TVs, so why bother with the dongle if it's already in the television to begin with?
Well, it's not built into all TVs, of course, is it?
No, but quite a lot. We've got Miracast.
And it's kind of it's one of those features that seems to get lost in amongst all the rest of it. So sometimes it's hard to access. So it kind of just brings to attention the functionality that exists, really. It's probably not as interesting as Chromecast, to me anyway, which works slightly differently. So this is draining your battery all the time you're using it. You're physically using that device to stream, whereas with Chromecast it works differently, whereas it'll just lock into the stream you've launched from your tablet or phone and therefore doesn't drain your battery, which makes it a little bit more usable for me anyway. The problem with Chromecast is it's very limited at the moment into what supports it. So you've got Netflix and YouTube in this country, and then likes of Hulu and a few other services in the States, but at the moment it's kind of limited, whereas Miracast isn't. But you need a phone or tablet that's dual band Wi-Fi to really make it work, because your video will be taken care of, video and audio will be taken care of on one band, whereas and all your networking stuff will be taken care of on the other band. So you need the right hardware combination. I imagine it's going to be cheap, and it might gain the attention of a few people. But it's kind of an indication of where the future is going. Although I tend to think it's a bit more Chromecast orientated than Miracast. But nonetheless, right. It's an interesting little device.
Okay. And one news story that I saw this morning actually was that Apple has reportedly bought a company called PrimeSense, who made the original Microsoft Kinect. I think the current Kinect that's going out with the Xbox One isn't made by PrimeSense. It's a different company. But they made the original Kinect, and I guess the thought process is that if Apple are buying that, they might be looking at doing something along the lines of a Kinect, but for either their TV or adding it as an add-on to the current Apple TV.
Or indeed a games console, maybe. Who knows? That'd shake things up a bit.
But right, is there room for another games console in the marketplace?
No. their days are numbered.
Apple, yeah, they're struggling, aren't they?
This is the last desperate act of a desperate company. Now we're going to go a games console or do a Kinect box or something.
The latest I read on their TV endeavours, the much rumoured TV endeavours, because they've never really said, is they're waiting for 4K to see how that establishes itself before even contemplating. So we're at least another 2 years, 3 years down the line before.
I'd say knowing Apple and their tendency to do fairly high spec and quality products, you know, or certainly aspirational products, it would make more sense for them to do a TV that combines OLED and 4K.
Yeah.
If you're going to do it at all. You know, and then throw in all, I mean, the problem they've got there is that, you know, to qualify as a TV, as opposed to a monitor, it has to have a tuner in it. And that, you know, that's an area that Apple has no experience in whatsoever. So they either need to buy a TV company, which is why there were a lot of rumors, I think, going around about Lerva about a year ago, who are, you know, financially in financial difficulties, as you discovered in one of your news stories.
Yeah.
They either need to buy a TV manufacturer in order to get the experience about how to develop tuners, because that's what defines something as a television. Or do they? Is it going to be the case that we've talked about this before? Are they just going to... you know, say, well, broadcast is the way the dodo, and we're going to stick with, you know, streaming and downloading, and that kind of technology is the way that TV is going to be delivered in the future.
On a more direct level. I just wondering, just looking at the article, could this be? I mean, thus far, all gesture based control systems, I look at them and go, no, it just doesn't strike me as a remotely more satisfying way of controlling a device than just like pointing a remote at it. If anyone, I suppose, can make it work, it might be Apple. But I don't know. This could be the acid test of whether, as a concept, it's just bobbins. Because if they can't make it work, I don't think anyone can.
Well, Mark and I have got quite a bit of experience of motion-controlled televisions. And
yeah, you often end up making it gestures that you aren't really intended when it doesn't work.
It's always easier to use a remote.
Yeah, gesture's awful. Gesture's awful. Voice is good. Voice can be really good these days. But yeah, not gesture. I'll never wave at my TV.
We're a long way from you know, Minority Report.
Yes, I think so. It'd be interesting to see what they say about the new Kinect, I guess.
Well, that'll be interesting. I guess we'll find out.
Because that should be pretty much state of the art as far as things go these days, I would have thought.
Yeah. Well, when they showed some of the stuff, I don't know if you caught the video with Yusuf Mehdi and Mark Witten, where they showed some of the UI and the like. But the switching between profiles by just picking out the face in the room and that kind of thing did look very cool, and it does seem to work as quickly as previously they'd claimed.
That's novel.
Is it twin proof?
What about if you're wearing a hat or something indoors with that?
I think I recognize
sunglasses
that.
And a Groucho Marx moustache.
Well, just have a hipster sensor, won't it?
Another news story of yours, Mark, is about 3G and 4G on planes.
Yeah. Sorry. I don't know where I went then.
Zoned out for a second. Then, didn't
just completely zoned. I was just thinking about the twin thing. Sorry, I just got sat in my mind thinking. Just give me 2 seconds.
Yeah, I'll bet you were.
No, I see.
Okay. Well, yeah, one of the things I didn't realise, sorry, Mark, not to interrupt there, is that this isn't relevant to the story you're about to talk about, but before that was the EU has allowed, or at least you can, if you want, if the airline will let you, you can use your mobile phone during landing and takeoff. Now, I've always known this to be the case. Mobile phones have absolutely no effect on airline, you know, on aircraft controls and functionality.
It'd be really worrying if it did.
Well, exactly, because I guarantee you on every single flight that takes off, there's a load of phones that people have left on by accident.
Yeah.
What it does do is they have a tendency to affect networks on the ground as the plane flies through different networks. There's absolutely no evidence or any case whatsoever that a mobile phone has ever in any way detrimentally affected an aircraft. And they made an aircraft that could be affected by a mobile phone. Well, that would be disastrous because you'd have terrorists bringing them down left, right and centre, wouldn't you? Just by making a call.
Messaging.
But isn't that a bit like, I mean, turning off your mobile phone at a petrol station or something like that?
Yeah, again,
that's a fire risk, isn't it?
Never ever happened. Never happened.
I'm sure it'll never happen. But yeah, as you say, the EC, EU, one of them, both of them, have green-lighted the use of 3G and 4G on aeroplanes. So it's not a right of the passengers that they like to put that out. It's as you say, down to the individual airlines as to whether they want to provide it. Presumably, they're going to need some hardware aboard the planes.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to get a signal at that.
You're not going to get a signal
at that altitude. I wouldn't at all. So I presume there'll be all sorts of tie-in deals now with various network providers, and I'm sure it'll cost you a fortune when you're sat on a plane accessing the airplane's 3G straight 4G network. But yeah, it's good common sense. It was only just a day after they approved the takeoff and landing, wasn't it? The Houston takeoff and landing. You've got to be 3,000 meters up, probably for the reasons we've just mentioned. Interfering with other networks. Yeah, apparently the reason, there's a good reason for not allowing you use of your mobile device during takeoff of landing, is it you need to be aware, because obviously this is the time when things go wrong on an aeroplane, so they don't want you playing Candy Crush as you're going up or down, in case you need to don the life jacket and man the emergency exits.
But don't inflate until you've left the plane.
Which would make sense if it wasn't for the fact that, you know, I'm reading a book while they're doing all that. They never stopped me from reading a book.
That's true. Maybe they'll buy
it. From my perspective, I mean, this is the old person in me talking. I just like the fact that it was one place where I didn't have to sit next to someone just yelling 19 to the dozen about just how important they believe themselves to be, or how aggrieved they are that someone has given some slight to them, real or perceived. It's just, it's hop, skip and a jump to just people just scrap. I mean, let's face it, with Wi-Fi on planes, which has been around for a bit now, I don't know about you, but if anyone ever seems to have it, all they seem to do is use it to update their Facebook status and go, I'm on a plane, LOL. I mean, that's the summation of what they seem to do with it. And that, you know, great, wow, Mankind took a big step forwards with that. So frankly, I'd have them, you know, locked, put in a locked holder at the end of the plane for the entire duration of the flight. But you know, that I guess I'm a minority in this one.
Well, when I lived in Hong Kong, they had they had these devices in the cinemas so that you couldn't get a mobile signal, stop people from basically, you know, finding their phones and be really annoying. And I think they should introduce that in all cinemas, because there's nothing more annoying than somebody talking on their phone or, you know, texting away while you're trying to watch a movie.
Unfortunately, Steve, it is illegal, because a good friend of mine, not for a cinema, he was actually looking at something he could just leave in his bag on the train and therefore just be a nice sort of 15-foot swathe where no one could actually get a phone signal around him. And no, that's not on, apparently. So you have to listen to people doing that. Although the only sort of joke, sort of moment of magic, a couple of years ago on the train, an incredibly drunk bloke, and he must have had a company iPhone and an iPod Touch. And the iPhone rang, and I just watched him for 30 seconds trying to answer the iPod Touch. That is the single amusing moment with people with a phone in a public place.
What's the legality then of me trying to shove the guy's phone up his self-righteous arse?
Well, so is that
frowned upon by the law?
Possibly assault. I guess it depends whether you could claim that you had some sort of justification. You know, I think self-defense would be a tricky one to argue if you proactively stuffed a phone up his arse.
I think it would be justifiable on the grounds that they're just really annoying. There would be a jury in the land that would convict me on that, in my opinion. Right, that's it for tech news. We'll be back in a second with the movie news. And the first thing we have to cover in movie news is, what was it, the cinema? Me. And I saw...
Someone else has done that bit. What was it, the cinema, Steve?
Thank you, Mark. Thank you. Yeah. It just doesn't work when you ask yourself the same question. I went to go and see The Counselor last night. Now, this is the new film from Ridley Scott, written by, screenplay by Cormac McCarthy, who is obviously a very well-known established writer. He wrote The Road. He wrote No Country for Old Men. The original novel's not the actual screenplay. This is his first ever screenplay. It's got an amazing cast. Michael Fassbender, Javier Bardem, Penelope Cruz, Cameron Diaz, Brad Pitt. And I can honestly say it was bloody awful. I've never been so bored in my life. Everyone talks in these long monologues about the meaning of life and death, the way that, you know, might look good in a, might read well in a book, or maybe even might work in a stage play, but really doesn't work in a film. It's quite obvious that Cormac McCarthy has no idea how to write a screenplay, because these interminably long soliloquies going on and on and on about stuff that had nothing to do with the plot. By the way, the plot, God knows. You feel like you started, the film starts halfway through the plot and doesn't really have an ending. You don't understand how, you don't know anything about any of the characters or why they're doing what they're doing. And I suppose you could say, well, it's not spoon-feeding you information. Yeah, but you've got to give us a bit of information. As just being really, you know, really abstract, it's just fundamentally annoying. I just thought, what a waste of talent and time and money. I mean, it looked beautiful. Obviously, it's shot by Ridley Scott. It's gorgeous. I was bored to tears. I kept looking at my watch thing, because is it ever going to end? It's only 2 hours long, but it felt a lot longer than that.
So what's it actually about?
Well, basically, the counsellor, so that's Michael Fassbender, who's a lawyer, he gets involved in a drug deal. So he's kind of working for various clients, one of whom is Javier Bardem, who owns a series of nightclubs, who's a bit shady in his own right. But Michael Fassbender goes into a drug deal where they buy these drugs, ship across the border, sell them into the States, make a big killing. And almost immediately it goes wrong. The shipment gets hijacked. And for some reason that's never really explained, he's therefore, they always assume that he stitched them up, and the guys who are doing the drug smuggling are therefore going to kill him. It's just, you know, you just think, okay, fine. But so Penelope Cruz's character gets kidnapped at one point and then just disappears, and you don't really know what happens to her. But then you ring up somebody and ask them what's going on, and you'll get a 10-minute monologue about the nature of life and death, and, you know, and what's grief mean, and what's this. And you're thinking, just get on with the plot. Shoot somebody, for God's sake. This sounds interesting.
I'm now intrigued as to whether this could be a duller film than The New World, the Terrence Malick one, which until now, that it's as slightly distinct from the worst film I've ever seen, it's certainly the dullest film I've ever seen. So now you've given me fresh hope that something even less interesting might be out there. So the next time I've got serious sleep deprivation issues, and once it's been released on either sort of Netflix or some other means of getting it without going to the cinema, I might have to give this a go. It sounds quite encouraging. As a means of curing my inability to go to sleep.
It would do that admirably, because I'll
tell you. Wonderful.
I've a few times in the cinema last night, just thinking, whoa. And then I thought, I bet this, because obviously I've seen No Country for Old Men, which does have a fairly strange ending where it kind of just ends. And I thought, I bet this does the same thing. I bet it just ends. And sure enough, it just ends. And there's no resolution. You know what happens to Fassbender's character? You never really find out. Well, you kind of get an idea what might happen to Penelope Cruz, but you're not exactly sure. You know, I think, well, hang on. Why is it even called The Counselor? Because he's not in it as much. He's hardly in the film either. It was a strange film. And you kind of think, why bother? It was one of those films where I sat at the end thinking, did I miss something? Is this really good and I'm just too stupid to appreciate it? Or, you know, why did anyone even bother making this? And I want my 2 hours back. At least it was free, I suppose. It could have been worse. You know,
marks out of 10, Steve.
Oh, I have to give it like a 3 or a 4. Just absolutely dreadful, dreadful film. Very disappointing from Ridley Scott. I mean, I would actually have gone, begged him to make another Prometheus movie, you know, after this, just because at least that wasn't, you know, you could look at it and enjoy it on a stupid level, even if it didn't make a lot of sense. This was just, you know, committed the terminal offense of any film, in my opinion, which is, it was boring. Never bore me at the cinema. Just, I don't care if you're rubbish, as low like Fast and the Furious. They're not masterpieces in any kind of real sense of the word, but they are always entertaining. And that's all I want to be. I just want to be entertained for 2 hours. Please, God, that's all I want.
It must be said, according to the fount of all knowledge that is Wikipedia, it is receiving mixed reviews. The Counselor raises expectations with its talented cast and creative crew, then subverts them with wordy and clumsy suspense that's mercilessly short on suspense or thrills.
Yep, that about sums it up. Could not put it better myself.
Lovely. Excellent. Well, that's one for the insomnia pile there.
Thank God. Kaz has got to write that review, not me. So let's see what he thought of it. Okay, moving on to the Bond franchise. Now, for those of you who maybe know a bit about the Bond, history of the Bond movies and the novels as well, back in the early 60s, before the first Bond film was made, Ian Fleming actually got together a guy called Kevin McClory to write a spec screenplay, a Bond screenplay, which they wrote together. Now, some of the key elements in the Bond, you know, Bond franchise came from that screenplay. Things like Spectre, things like Blofeld. The screenplay was called Warhead. It eventually got made as Thunderball. Now, there was a massive court case at the time between Kevin McClory and Ian Fleming regarding basically the film rights to the Bond franchise. They made the agreement. The court case ended up with an agreement to make Thunderball. And Kevin McClory is listed as the only producer on that film, even though it was actually funded and made predominantly by Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman at the time. He then, under the terms of that agreement, couldn't be involved with Bond again. I think it was for 10 or 20 years. As soon as that was up, he started trying to finance another remake, which became, of course, Never Never Again in 1983, which is just a remake of Thunderball, basically. He was then trying to make another Bond film. Well, I've been trying to make Bond films ever since, basically. He's been a constant thorn in the side of the guys who actually do make the Bond films, in Cubby Broccoli's production company. But after his death in 2006, the rights were bought by MGM and Cubby Broccoli's company, Aeon Productions. So they have now all that stuff that was covered under the original Warhead script, all the elements of the Bond franchise that were technically could have been owned by Kevin McClory, are now all owned by Cubby Broccoli's company, by Aeon Productions, which means that there's a good chance we might get Blofeld in the next Bond film, which I think is quite exciting because we're getting back to some more classic Bond, really.
Whilst I don't have a problem getting back to classic Bond, I think Spectre, and it is Spectre, Steve, not Spectra, is...
Ooh, pedant.
It needed to be pointed out. It just is willfully archaic. And what's bizarre is that it's archaic despite being... in certain respects, entirely believable, because you have organisations now which operate on a level of equivalency in size and scope to governments. And that isn't in any way weird. That's 2013. That's how it happens. But, you know, sort of lots and lots of uniformed henchmen and, you know, various, you know, nicking nuclear weapons and stuff like that. It's all just weirdly archaic. And
why is within that archaic?
Because it doesn't, essentially, if you are a giant corporation these days, you can be just as unbelievably dominant by screwing everyone financially and entirely legally. What's the point of running around with lots of guns and weapons?
Because it's fun to be evil and do nasty things.
I don't disagree with that, but there's evil takes many forms, Steve. And plus,
James Bond doing a tax audit wouldn't be quite as interesting.
Well, all I would say is that, ironically, even though it wasn't actually a desperately good Bond film, the best example of the 21st century Blofeld equivalent is Elliot Carver in Tomorrow Never Dies.
That's true, actually. That is a good point. I mean, they did try and obviously replace Spectre by having the Quantum Organization they started off in Casino Royale, and obviously it was a major part of Quantum of Solace, although it was conveniently forgotten again when they got to Skyfall. But I think that was obviously their attempt to have something similar when they couldn't technically use the rights at the time for legal reasons. Maybe now they can. They'll sort of ditch the whole Quantum thing and go back to Spectra. Or maybe Quantum will you know, morph into Spectra. But I want to see a bald-headed guy. I know it's quite difficult now, post-Austin Powers, to really look at Blofeld without laughing. So maybe you have to do a bit of a reboot on the whole character and the nature of the character, because a guy in a Nero suit.
I think they should bring him back as Henry Blofeld, the cricket commentator. I think there was some correlation, isn't there, between that? Wasn't Ian Fleming at school with Henry Blofeld's dad, and therefore he wasn't actually came
that
from.
That might well be the case, yes.
Yeah, but I think my dear old thing. I mean, he'd make an excellent weird Bond villain.
I don't know. As long as he's got a cat, you know. Let's be clear.
I'm sure Henry's got a cat or two.
But yeah,
I've got a cat, and I'm not an evil villain. Here we go.
Okay.
Right. That's Bond for you. And just a possibility we might see some of the old elements of the Bond franchise back now that the rights have reverted back to Cubby Rockley's company. This is one for you, Ed. Netflix. They are saving The Killing. They've ordered 6 more episodes after it was cancelled.
Hooray, me and the 6 other people that apparently watch it will be delighted. I didn't realise it's quite such a... I thoroughly enjoyed it as a premise. I thought that Seattle was a wonderful place to restage it. And I've genuinely enjoyed the two main characters in it. And I'm very glad that they've done it. 6 episodes sounds a bit cutting it a bit fine, but yeah, I wish them the very best of luck, and I will be enthusiastically watching it as and when it hits our screens. And I urge anyone that hasn't watched it to just go at it with an open mind and see what you think. I mean, in many ways, if you wanted a tighter seeing it at its best, you can watch the third season without having watched the first two. And the third season avoided some of the mistakes of the first two. And to my mind, it was one of the very finest bits of television that I've watched this year. I would say, contentiously, I felt it was as good in parts as Netflix's House of Cards, which obviously very, very well received and is very, very bloody good, with every justification.
Thank you, Ed. High praise indeed. And finally, now I'm sure most people will know, this Saturday is the 50th anniversary of Doctor Who. It's been 50 years since its first broadcast on 23rd of November 1963, the day after Kennedy was assassinated. And to celebrate, the BBC have got quite a lot of things on this week, actually. And on Thursday night, they're showing Adventure in Space and Time, which is a TV film about the creation of the series. And obviously on Saturday, they have the big Day of the Doctor 3D special, with not just Matt Smith as the Doctor, but also David Tennant coming back as Doctor Who, Billy Piper coming back, and John Hurt as the War Doctor, as he's now being known, because there was a 7-minute sort of prequel that was released on online last week called Night of the Doctor, which I have to say, I'm a bit geeky here, but was brilliant because it had Paul McGann playing the Doctor again for the first time since the 1996 movie, and they gave him a regeneration scene at long last. So I thought they tied up a few loose ends on that one. So full credit to Stephen Moffat for doing that. And I've got to say, personally, quite excited about the fact it's in 3D, I will actually have the 84-inch Toshiba 4K TV to watch it on in 3D on Saturday. And it's the last BBC production, I think, that currently they'll be doing in 3D after they sort of kind of cancelled that, really. You know, big special for the 50th anniversary. I'm quite excited. You guys?
Give a toss.
Right, that was short and sweet then. Thank you and good night.
I don't know. I respect the fact that it's been very long lived, that we've seen some bold concepts. It's achieved huge amounts, often on budgets that are just laughable. Do I actually care? A more significant and profound question. No, not really. Oh, no, this is fun. Not only do I have one cat in here, I've now got two. That's not going to go down well. No, sorry.
A horror film where they're just collecting outside the front door waiting to eat you.
Well, no, they're just going to have a spat at each other. If you hear noises in the background, that's nothing I can do about that. I just can't get that excited. But I respect the fact that it's such a big deal. And every now and again, there'll be nothing else on and there'll be a rerun of Doctor Who on Dave Gold or whatever it is, and it'll be fine, and I will you know, enjoy watching it for a bit, but I just can't get that excited. Sorry. Although that said, if you were asking me to choose, as I believe that is on
I'm
on
about
the cards,
to ask you to choose your favorite Doctor, so please at least have an answer for that.
Mainly because I love him as an actor. I love almost everything he's ever done. Christopher Eccleston. There, said it.
Okay. Mark B.
Tom Baker for the scarf. I struggled to pick one, I'll be honest.
What about you, Mr. Hodge?
Tom Baker, definitely. That was when I was growing up, when Doctor Who was big, when I was, 7 or 8, 9, that kind of age. It was Baker, and his campness and just general over-the-top persona kind of suited the Doctor down to the ground for me. I never really enjoyed it since he left.
The Radio Times did a poll and their readers voted David Tennant as the favourite Doctor, but I noticed it was all really heavily skewed towards the recent Who stuff, classic Who stuff. Same thing with the assistants, you know, they voted, I think Elizabeth Sladen was voted favourite assistant, or was it Rose, Billy Piper, but you know, it's kind of, again, they've both been around a lot recently, although sadly Elizabeth Sladen's obviously dead now. But it was definitely skewed towards the modern viewership rather than the more classic Who. I actually remember, not very well, but I do remember watching some of the late John Pertwee stuff. And that was my first exposure to Doctor Who, which meant I did resent Tom Baker initially. Because, you know, I wasn't really used to this whole concept. It is a brilliant idea, and the reason the TV show still exists now and it's been doing so well is the idea of regeneration, bringing in a new actor. And I resented Tom Baker initially because he wasn't John Pertwee. But then I realised after a year or so that Baker was a genius and what he was doing was really, really clever. You know, I think it's just amazing that they can actually have a live primetime show now where they announce a new Doctor. That's how big it's become. But so it's full credit to the BBC and to Russell T. Davis for I think Mark just pointed out, Mark Botwright's pointed out, by choosing Christopher Eccleston. Who said Christopher Eccleston? Was it Botwright?
No, it's me.
Oh, sorry, Ed. Yes. As Ed pointed out, by picking a really good actor to reboot the series, or relaunch the series, I think he gave it gravitas and credibility that it would never have had otherwise. But my favourite Doctor is Tom Baker as well.
I mean, hang on a second. I mean, obviously, I know we're missing Simon Crust, and you know he
knows a lot about Doctor Who.
He does know. I thought there was only he could only do a finite number of regenerations. Surely we've now reached that.
Yeah, they kind of swept that one under the carpet a little bit, I think. You are right. I think it was 13 regenerations originally, but that's kind of been. But there's always been quite a bit of retconning going on over the years, like avoiding certain things. Because I didn't have a granddaughter in the original William Hartnell series. That seems to have disappeared slowly. But anyway. So Doctor Who, 5th anniversary this Saturday. If you're a fan or even curious or like 3D perhaps, then watch it on Saturday.
Interested in 3D? Why
not? Because it'll be a last chance.
I've got to say, MasterChef The Professionals is now in full swing, and that's the BBC. The BBC is earning its license fee for me. I just love it. Just watching Greg Human Pudding Wallace and his facial expressions. That's just a wonderful way to wrap up an evening. It's fantastic. I just sit there with one of my many cats on me and, yeah, just enjoy it.
It's a wonderful way to wrap up a podcast too. Thank you, Ed. Right, that's it for AB Forum's podcast for this week. My thanks to Mark Botwright.
Right up to the end.
Oh, God, Jesus. I really should have picked a different film, shouldn't I? Yes. It sounded funny at the time, but it's not funny at all. Mark Hoskinson.
Right. Sorry, I'm just preparing myself. Nurse, I dreamt about you last night. Did you? No, you wouldn't let me. Sorry.
You can't do dialogue.
But that's all there is.
It's a quote.
It's going to be funny.
That is a quote. It's extended.
And
all right, it's... then. No, you wouldn't let me.
You sounded so sad then, Mark.
Oh, Christ.
It sounded like you were speaking from experience. Mm. And Mr. Selly?
Burgundy.
You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And don't forget to mark us avforums.com for the latest reviews, news, and videos. Plus, why not leave us a rating on iTunes if you enjoyed the show. I'm Steve Withers. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next Wednesday.